Hello, my friends, and welcome to another Robcast. This is episode 181, and it's called You and Your Bookkeeping, because it's time for another sermon. Or maybe you could say, You and Your Bookkeeping. So I'm sitting here at my desk with a microphone plugged into a laptop. By the way, I should tell you about this desk. My friend bought me this desk in the year 2000. I'm in my 18th year of sitting at this desk. Like, this desk has been home base for a while. But an interesting thing happened about a year ago. About a year ago, my beloved 17-year-old son, Preston, took over my desk. I mean, it was a full-scale invasion. And now he uses the desk every day. And I am deskless. I wander the land with my notebook and laptop. But let me just for a moment, just to show you how glorious this particular human being is, let me just tell you, so literally once a week when I do this Robcast, I just push all of his belongings forward and make a little space for the laptop and mic. And then by later today, I'm sure all of these things, like the tide, will have sort of washed back into the empty space. But let me, just for the pure joy of it, let me just point out to you what is on this desk. So first off, I can count four cameras that I can see, including a Polaroid and several boxes of Instax Polaroid instant film, a couple pairs of In-N-Out Burger tube socks, all kinds of music recording equipment. So like a direct box, some strings, guitar cleaner, a bunch of quarter-inch cables, a box of painting supplies, like oil, or I guess these would be watercolor supplies, and including a stack of paintings he's done, including a reproduction of the opening scene of the show Twin Peaks, done with a paintbrush, a Def Cab for Cutie vinyl record, a stack of blank CDs, because he burns CDs to listen to in his car. And then we have David Byrne's book, How Music Works. We have the Wife of the Joy Division Singers book about Ian Curtis. We have Lizzie Goodman's book, Meet Me in the Bathroom. And then a car, because he has his first car, two spray bottles of car cleaner that were given to him by his grandfather for Christmas. Are you with me on that? And then a plastic tube of party supplies, like those like firework things that you throw on the ground. It's like neutered California fireworks. And then, here we go, two season two and season three, the complete box set of Simpsons episodes. You know, see what I'm saying? Is this a glorious human being? It's like a trip inside of his mind, and it's absolutely fantastic. Now, speaking of trips, ladies and gentlemen, the Holy Shift Tour, next stop, Texas. In the month of February, I will be deep in the heart of Texas with the one and only Pete Rollins, who's opening. And this tour, I'm telling you, we're going to do two nights in Austin. Then we'll do Houston, Dallas. I'll be at the Majestic in Dallas. I love that theater. And then Tobin Performing Arts Center in San Antonio. So tickets are at robbell.com. And this tour, seriously, seriously, Texas, prepare thyself. And then next Largo show is February 5th. I have all these new pictures I need to show you. You know, my picture shows at Largo are seriously so much fun. And then I might be reading you some things. And then John Philip Newell, one of the spiritual teachers, poets, mystics, who has most shaped and influenced me. He'll be joining me for part of my Largo show, which is an honor, to say the least. And then those of you communicators, those of you who take ideas and give them shape and form, there's a couple spots left for my March Something to Say workshop. And you bring what you're working on, and then I dive into it with you, and everybody, we get you unstuck, and things happen in that space. Yeah, and the space actually is the lab at the Improv Comedy Club here in Los Angeles. So there's a couple spots left for that. Those are things that are happening. But now what's happening is a sermon, right? It's time for a sermon. And this sermon is called You and Your Bookkeeping. You and Your Bookkeeping. Last episode was You and Your Bags of Gold. So there's like an arc to these And this one, as you'll see, it sort of talks to the previous episode about the bags of gold, this bookkeeping one. You'll see how, you'll see what Jesus is doing here, or what the writers who arrange this material is doing. And so this story, this sermon is based on a parable that Jesus tells in the Gospel of Matthew chapter 18. The parable is sometimes called the parable of the unmerciful servant. Sometimes it's called the parable of the unforgiving servant. And it begins, one of Jesus' students, a man named Peter, he came to Jesus and asked, "Lord, how many times shall I forgive someone who sins against me? Up to seven times?" Now, the question is, where does Peter get the number seven? This is all actually a reference to a story in the first book of the Bible, Genesis chapter 4. So when Peter says, okay, somebody wrongs me, I get screwed over, how many times do I have to forgive them? Seven. He isn't just pulling seven out of nowhere. He's pulling seven out because as a good first century Jewish kid, he's got these stories deep in his bones, and he's making reference to a story without naming it, because Jesus would have understood what story he's referring to. Jesus answers him, "I tell you, not seven times, but 77 times," which is a fantastic answer because it's not an answer. Jesus is not saying, hey, 78th time, bring down the hammer. Up until there, first 77, let him go. No, he's not actually answering and giving an answer. He's spoofing. It's like a wink and a nudge. It's like a nod. It's like an inside joke. It's like Peter's question is absurd. It's like, do I really have to forgive seven times? And when Jesus says, nope, but you have to record 77, it's as if Jesus responds to an absurd question with an absurd answer. You see that? It's like it's all over the top, and here's why. Then he shifts gears. Jesus answered, therefore, and when you see a therefore, you have to ask, you know, what's it there for? So it's like he's shifting gears to give his real response to the question of forgiveness. Therefore, the kingdom of heaven is like a king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. As the king began the settlement, a man who owed him 10,000 bags of gold was brought to him. Okay, this, seriously, this is such mass, just set aside from all the places we're going to go in the next little bit here. Let's just begin with, this is such good storytelling, and here's why. It's an impossible sum of money. When the king is settling his accounts and a man who owes him 10,000 bags of gold is brought to him, if you were in the first century crowd, you would have been like, that's impossible. That just can't happen. Here's why. The general belief is that a bag of gold would have been roughly worth the same as 20 years of working every day. The wages that you would get from 20 years of day labor. So when this man owes 10,000 bags of gold, a lot of scholars would say, essentially, the man owes 200,000 years' wages. And for the people who had been listening to this story, that's like, you owe 200,000 years' wages. That's just not something you're ever going to be able to pay back. See, it's an absurd story, which is part of Jesus' point. He's coming in the side door again. It's like he's playing with you. He's like he's punking you. The premise is ridiculous. This would never happen. It's surreal. It's farce. You know what it is? It's the opening scene of La La Land. You know what I'm talking about, right? The freeway scene. Because you don't quite know what kind of movie you're getting into. The first scene is like, oh, okay. Apparently, all of the rules of standard operating traffic procedure are going to be suspended in this movie. That's oftentimes what a master storyteller does, is right away, it's like they say to you, this is how I tell stories. So La La Land, one of my top five favorite movies ever. The beautiful thing about that opening scene is it's so over the top and ridiculous. It's almost like the director goes, okay, you coming with me? Are you coming? Can you do? If you can do this, you're going to be fine. You know what I mean? But sit back, and you're in new territory now. So Jesus begins this story with a king who wants to settle accounts, because that's what you do when you're a king, is you run your kingdom. There's a man who owes him the sum of money. The man comes in, but the one detail Jesus tweaks is the man owes a sum of money that nobody would ever owe at that time. So, next line of the story. Since he was not able to pay, The king ordered that he and his wife and his children and all that he had be sold to repay the debt. Okay. At first, here, the king is proceeding like a good king, or to be more precise, like a good bookkeeper. The king here is doing what you do when you run a kingdom. He's got two columns. People who owe him, people he owes, I assume. Money coming in, money going out. So far in the story, the king is following the process of good bookkeeping for a first century king. Now, it's horrific and barbaric selling off someone's family. Obviously, we all get that. But that's how these kinds of things worked at that time. The crowd would not have been shocked with a master, boss man, servant who threw somebody in jail because of their debts. That's the way it worked. The king in the story is simply doing what kings do. He's settling accounts, he's paying bills, he's tracking invoices, he's holding debtors accountable. If he were to do anything else, obviously, imagine the message that would send throughout the kingdom. The king's gone soft, you can take advantage of the king, right? So he's got to somehow have some sense of like, you don't mess with the king, okay? The servant, upon hearing this, is obviously terrified. The servant fell on his knees before the king. Be patient with me, he begged, and I will pay back everything. Okay. See, the king's good bookkeeping is going to put this man's family in jail, right? He's going to lose all of his possessions, and he and his kids and wife are headed to prison. That's the result of the king's good bookkeeping. Basic king accounting practices are going to put this man and his family destitute in prison. So the man makes a request. Be patient with me and I will pay back everything. Okay. You're with me on this, right? You're a step ahead, correct? Because the premise is absurd. So when the man says, be patient with me, I will pay back everything, it's an absurd request. It's an impossible request. He asks for the king to be patient, like, just give me time. But the man owns, what does he owe? 200,000 days of labor? Time isn't going to help this man. By the way, this is funny. Like, I assume the crowd would have laughed. Like, this is really, really funny. It's like if you said to me, Rob, you owe me $43 million. And I was like, oh, okay, well, hey, no problem. Can you give me till Thursday? You see, I would have larger problems at that moment than Thursday. So the request is ridiculous. But here's the thing. Here, and I would argue this is the whole story in some sense. This is one of the key moments in the story. The man's request is ridiculous because he doesn't have enough time to pay, no amount of time. So when he asks the king this, but here's the thing, his request is according to the rules of bookkeeping. The request is according to the rules of proper accounting. Do you see how warped the servant's thinking is? The man who owes this money. Do you see how warped his thinking is? It's an impossible sum, but he clearly hasn't faced the impossibility of the bookkeeping of it. He's acting like it's not impossible, like he could somehow rustle up 200,000 years of day labor. Like if I told you that you owed the government $11 million and you said, well then, I think I'll start driving Uber in my spare time. I'd be like, I don't think you understand how serious this is. I don't think picking up a couple hours in a part-time job is going to make much of a dent in the $11 million that you owe. Do you see what I'm saying? The man hasn't clearly grasped the impossibility of it. He either hasn't heard the king or he just doesn't get it. There's something in him that refuses to face just how big the debt is. So he's still trapped in bookkeeping. Bookkeeping world is still where he resides. I owe a bunch of money. I just need more time. And according to the laws of good bookkeeping, somehow if I just have more time, I can make this right according to the laws of good bookkeeping. The servant's master, the king, here's how the story goes, took pity on him, canceled the debt, and let him go. By the way, the phrase took pity, the word pity in Greek is the word splangdon, splangstomai, I think it's sometimes pronounced. Splankton, it refers to your innards. Some have translated it your guts, your liver, your intestines. It's a great word. The servant's master took pity on him, essentially felt deep in his guts for the man. The king canceled the debt and let him go. Now, a couple things about this. First off, the king does not respond to the man's efforts. Are you with me on this? The man's efforts, hey, just give me time and I'll pay it back, got him nothing because they're ridiculous. The man's efforts were completely impotent in the face of this debt. The man in debt imagines, for according to his conception, the king is just like him, trapped in bookkeeping. So the man who has the debt makes his case based on the logic of bookkeeping, right? But the Jesus story here, in this story, the king cancels the debt, and we're never given reasons why. So instead of doing good bookkeeping, the king tosses the books. The king dies to his bookkeeping. And we don't know why. We get no information on why the king does what kings don't do, right? Other than he took pity on him. He felt for this man in his splankton. But whatever it is, the king abandons good bookkeeping. The king dies to the bookkeeping. He tosses the books. He's not playing that game anymore. And here's the second, third, fourth layer of this. It's not that the king is doing better bookkeeping or more compassionate accounting or more generous bookkeeping. It's that he leaves that entire framework behind. Man, suffering raises all sorts of questions. Why this pain? Why this hell on earth? Cancer, war, betrayal, natural disasters. Suffering raises all sorts of questions, right? Pain, the anguish of the world. If you're like me, if you have your eyes, if you don't have questions about the agony of this life, then your eyes aren't open. You're not awake. Suffering raises all sorts of questions, but so does grace. So does grace. So does the canceling of debts. So does generosity that appears to come out of nowhere. See what this story does? So what this story does is right in the center of it. It's almost like the pivot, the hinge of the whole thing is the king, because of reasons internal and only known to the king, the king's like, tosses the books. I'm not doing the bookkeeping with this guy. You're free. Go. You're free. And that's all we get. Suffering raises all sorts of questions. And if you don't have questions about that, man, your eyes aren't open. But I would argue grace raises just as many questions. Liberation, unmerited favor, kindness, beauty, good graffiti. You're driving down the road and there's ugly and all of a sudden there's a giant painting on the side of a building. You're like, wow, that is amazing. Yeah, that raises just as many questions. That raises just as many questions. Now the story goes on. But when the man went out, he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 silver coins. which was roughly somewhere around the daily wage of a day laborer. Okay, so apparently somebody owed him about what you'd make for working for a day. The man grabbed the man who owed him that much money and began to choke him. "Pay back what you owe me," he demanded. His fellow servant fell to his knees and begged him, "Be patient with me and I will pay you back." Ah, we've heard this line before. But he refused. Instead, he went off and had the man thrown into prison until he could pay the debt. When the other servants saw what had happened, they were greatly distressed and went and told the king everything that had happened. Then the master called the king, called the servant in. "You wicked servant," he said. "I canceled all that debt of yours because you begged me to. Shouldn't you have had mercy on your fellow servant just as I had on you?" In anger, his master handed him over to the jailers to be tortured until he should pay back all he owed. This is how my... And then Jesus adds this. "This is how my heavenly Father will treat each of you unless you forgive a brother or sister from your heart." Oh, yes. And that is how the parable ends. I know. Tell me you aren't like, what? Wait, what? I know. First off, I mean, it's just masterful storytelling. Think of how much gets packed into just a couple lines there. Oh, my word. Okay, now, let's pull this apart. And especially that last part where the guy gets tortured, we're especially going to camp out there in a little bit here because we have to cover that because my reading of that is... Man. Yeah, we'll get to that, okay? So, first off, there you have the rest of the story. Now, why is this huge? Okay, the man who owed the money, for some reason, the king, the master, cancels all his debts. Then he turns around, goes out, runs into a guy who owes him a tiny bit of money, and he won't. And the man begs him, "Hey, just give me time." And he's like, "No," and has him thrown in prison. Okay. The man here demonstrates that he missed what just happened with the king. It went right over his head. Or to be more precise, it went right over his heart. So here's all you can surmise from the story. The man who was forgiven 200,000 years of labor's wages, okay, he actually thinks the king has responded to his offer. Right? He leaves the encounter unchanged by what just happened. He doesn't get it. He's still playing the old game. He's unaffected. He's still clinging to bookkeeping. He hasn't died to the bookkeeping. Are you with me on this? So all the way through the parable, he keeps playing by the rules of bookkeeping, even when the master... The king tosses out the books. The king decides not to keep score. But this man is so stuck in the keeping score that he clings to his books the whole way through the story. Now, that'll come up in a minute here when we talk about torture. But first off, a few big ideas. The king switches modes. The king moves from bookkeeping to something else. Grace, mercy, pity. He has a stirring in his splankton. The king switches into a different mode. And what was required for him to switch into a new mode was he had to die to the bookkeeping. He lets it go. He goes from bookkeeping to grace. And this is our invitation. By the way, I'm not obviously not talking to all of you CPAs out there and everybody who runs a household and everybody has to pay taxes in April, right? Right? We're not talking about that. We're talking about, well, the kingdom of heaven. We're talking about the spiritual realm. We're talking about the deepest depths of life, how we see the whole thing. Do you see the subtle connection with the last episode and the bags of gold? There's a death here just below the surface that animates the whole thing. It's like there's this engine, this engine of mystery that turns the whole thing upside down. And if you're not paying attention, you can miss the whole thing. Because that's the problem with the man who owed all the money, is this mysterious power of grace and mercy washes over him when the king tosses the books. But he misses it and stays stuck in the old mode of, you owe me and you better pay up, and I owe, so I'm going to pay up. The king switches modes. The servant doesn't. He's still clinging to his books. He doesn't enter into the strange, mysterious grace of the king tossing his books. And so he goes out and he doesn't pass along this strange mystery of grace. He stays stuck in the old mode and has a guy who owes him just a couple dollars thrown in prison. There is a truth. There is an invitation for you to switch modes. Like the number of leaders I've interacted with who are trying to get their people to do something. There's like a hint of control. There's an anxiety. There's a stress. How do I get my people in line? How do I get the people to do the thing? Employees, members, constituents. Maybe one of the ways you do it is you die to the need to control people. And on the other side, you move in some different way. Or the number of parents who are trying to get their kids to, maybe the way that it works is you die to all that need to control and manage and manipulate and coerce your kids. Or the people I've met who are trying to make money, like they're like, they have to make a bunch of money for some reason. Maybe the way that you make money is you die to that understanding of how you make money. And maybe on the other side, you'll make even more, but it'll be in a completely different way. The number of times I've interacted with people and they're in a mode that would never, ever produce what they want it to produce. Their fundamental posture towards their kids is stress, anxiety, control, and then they wonder why their kids give all this negativity back to them. It's because the kids are just reflecting it back. Or the people who are trying to be successful, and the way they understand successful is winning, which means somebody else has to lose. Well, then it'll never be joyful. It'll never even be successful because it's the wrong mode. Or the people trying to make money who are like, well, I need to get my slice of the pie. Well, that's your problem right there. It's wrong metaphor, because a pie is a limited sum. And it implies that if somebody gets a bigger slice and everybody else got a smaller slice, instead of a generative reality. Yeah. Yeah. You see what I'm saying here? This king moves to a different mode. And the man who owes all the money stays stuck in the old mode. Now, side note, a few truths about forgiveness. Because in one simple, very straightforward way to read the story is forgive other people because you've been forgiven, which is beautiful. But let's just do a few things. And I did a whole thing a while ago, I think a whole week of Robcasts about forgiveness. So it's important to remember, forgiveness is not approval. Forgiveness is not condoning what the person did. Forgiveness doesn't even mean you have to like the person. Forgiveness is for sure not reconciliation. You can forgive somebody, but reconciliation takes two, and they may have no interest in reconciliation or peacemaking. So you can forgive them without anything. People don't have to do something for you to forgive them. By the way, forgiveness doesn't mean that you don't have boundaries. In fact, forgiving somebody may mean that for the first time you make boundaries. You can forgive somebody from a distance. You can forgive somebody and never be in the same room with them. You can forgive somebody and limit all of your contact with them to short phone calls. Sometimes with toxic, destructive people who will just tear you down, no matter how close they are to you, you can't have contact with them, and yet you forgive them so that you're free from bitterness. Forgiveness does not mean continuing the relationship as it always has been. You may forgive someone and never see them again. So let's just be really clear. Forgiveness is when you set somebody free and find out that it's you. And once again, there's a bunch of podcasts on this, but it's important to just always, always, always say that. And that forgiveness is a process. Forgiveness might simply mean that tomorrow you are less bitter than you are today. Hey, we'll take it wherever we can get it. Second thing about forgiveness, you don't forgive someone because they deserve it. Now, you never forgive somebody because they deserve it. Forgiveness has nothing to do with them, has nothing to do with whether they deserve it or not, or whether they seem to understand it, or whether they're apologized or not. Forgiveness has absolutely nothing to do with whether or not somebody apologizes for wronging you. Yeah, it's completely independent. Because if it does, then you would be waiting for them to apologize, and they may never apologize. So you would then be in bondage to your bitterness till the day you die. Why live like that? Think about it. When you wrong somebody, your basic argument to them is, I know I don't deserve it, but please forgive me, right? When we are the one who did the wronging, the first thing we appeal to is grace. Please extend me grace. Now, when we say that somebody doesn't deserve it, what we're doing is we're clinging to our bookkeeping. Yeah, we're like, no way. I know what you did, and this is what you owe. So when you forgive somebody, what you're passing along to them is what you have been given. You didn't deserve it, and so you're passing along the not deservingness. How's that for a word? Not deservingness. Now, let's push a little farther. Let's go to the end of the story. Because at the end of the story, the man is thrown in prison and tortured. Which sounds like, wait. And then Jesus adds this line, this is how your heavenly Father will treat you. And you're like, wait, where's all the love and grace and compassion? Okay, here's the deal. It's not harsh. It's perfectly accurate. And here's why. When you cling to your bookkeeping, it's a form of torture. Yeah, see? A lot of people take the end of the parable literally. Wait. The story begins with a completely surreal situation in which a man owes way more money than you could ever owe. Jesus says, we already are dancing on the hoods of cars on the 405 freeway in LA, right? Right? We're already the opening scene of La La Land. So at the end, you can't switch from the surreal farce to something else. You got to stay with it the whole way. So when Jesus says, oh, the man's going to get tortured, yes, it's a perfect way to describe what happens when you cling to your bookkeeping. When you cling to, you owe me and I'm going to hold it over your head. Here's the thing. God will let you cling to your bookkeeping. Not forgiving somebody is a form of torture. It eats away at you. I mean, it eats away for them. It eats away for you. When we stay trapped in, I'm not going to give somebody that they don't deserve, you're clinging to your books, and it's a form of torture. A lot of people say, like, I don't believe in a God who would send people to hell or torture them. I don't either. We send ourselves there without any help. We don't need any divine assistance to create our own hells. Are you with me on this? We create our own hells when we cling to our bookkeeping of who deserves what. And what Jesus does here is tells a story about somebody who owes a massive sum and they are forgiven. The debts are canceled, a free gift of grace, and we don't ever find something internal to the master, to the king. He has his own reasons, which we aren't privy to. It's a mystery. We create our own hells when we do not enter into that mystery, and instead we cling to our bookkeeping. You owe me 17 bucks. And here's the thing. Here's what Jesus is doing in the story. God lets us, because love wins. I had to. Love doesn't override the will. If the ground of being is love, then love will let you cling to your bookkeeping if you want. It's as if the divine says, you want that? Seriously. You're choosing your little ledger with its columns of who owes you what and who wronged you and look what they did to me in college and look what my ex-partner did to... You're going to cling to all that. Really. You want to do that. You want to play by the books. All right. It's almost as if... It's as almost as if the divine says, okay, fine, you can cling to your bookkeeping, but that's your idea, not mine. Because in the story that Jesus tells, the king, the master, we could say a stand-in for the divine, the stand-in for ultimate reality, if that helps you better there. Yeah, the stand-in for the ground of your being operates in a completely different economy of grace, favor, blessing, gift, and the canceling of debts. So you can allow yourself to be forgiven the debts. You can enter in to the extraordinary, over-the-top gift of grace, or you can stay stuck in your bookkeeping, but your bookkeeping will always lead you to some form of torture. If you are waiting for somebody to reform, if you're waiting for them to change their behavior, if you're waiting for them to stop drinking, if you're waiting for them to suddenly not be so nasty so that you can then forgive them, you may wait your entire life. If forgiveness is based on what they do, then you are at some level eternally screwed. But if you enter in to a new mode now and you pass along what isn't deserved because you've received what isn't deserved, now you actually have a shot at joy. The king is not being cruel. The king is giving the man what he wants. The man wants to cling to his bookkeeping. The bush is burning. The sea has parted. The dead have been raised. All the debts have been canceled. The slaves have been freed. The Cubs won the World Series. It's all one giant miracle. Are you with me on this? But the servant insists on clinging to his old, tired bookkeeping. You owe me, so I'm throwing you in prison. The whole story is about a man who doesn't get what has happened to him. He's still clinging to his story, his version of events, his sense of justice, and who's gotten enough, and who deserves this, and who deserves that. He still thinks the king actually listened to his request. Just give me time. He still is grasping those narrow columns of who I owe and who owes me. Now, let's make this really, really personal for a second. And we probably should do a whole episode on this at some point in the near future. But those of you who have a hard time forgiving yourself, you're like, oh yeah, I can forgive others, but it's myself that I have a hard time with. If you want to block the flow of love and grace to yourself, then don't extend it to others. Just stay in the bookkeeping. But if you want to be freed yourself, if you want to enter into the forgiving yourself, you start forgiving others and just keep repeating, of course they don't deserve it. Of course they don't deserve it. Of course they don't deserve it. This will radically transform how you view your own story. And specifically those of you with regrets, wounds, mistakes, things you've done that haunt you. Give people what they don't deserve. Practice this and see what this does inside of you. Extend people things they clearly do not deserve. And say it as like a mantra to yourself. Of course they don't deserve this. Of course they don't deserve this. And see if you find yourself with the mantra turned back on you. Of course I don't deserve it. And see if you say it enough, if you don't begin to smile. Of course I don't deserve it. That's the language of bookkeeping, and we died to bookkeeping. You see how there's a death that leads to life in all of this? Come on, come on, come on. Right, and when does Jesus start telling parables like this? He has, at one point in the Gospels, he starts to tell his disciples, hey, I know you're thinking of me as the standard Messiah, right? I'm feeding the sick. I'm healing the sick. I'm feeding the hungry. I'm helping the poor. I'm giving good talks. I got a big crowd, right? Right? He's like, this is like Messiah 101. Like, I'm the savior you're looking for. I'm exactly who you've been waiting for. But then he starts saying, oh, by the way, I'm going to die. Headed to Jerusalem to a confrontation. So it's then the parables shift, and the teachings he starts giving are about some sort of mystery wrapped up in some sort of death that somehow leads to some sort of new life. Are you with me? Now, some call this gospel, but gospel for so many people got so bastardized as just one more form of work. Are you with me on this? It was like, well, you got to believe and you got to keep your theology correct and you got to be in the right club and you got to get other people in the club. Are you seeing what I'm saying? A lot of people, gospel turned into just another form of bookkeeping. Who's in, who's out, who believes the right things, who's got questionable theology, who's a heretic, who's orthodox, when the story is so much better than that. The good news is better than that. The gospel is better than that. It's the mystery hidden in the whole thing. And once again, in this story, it's like the king dies to the bookkeeping game. And that's the engine of the whole thing. By the way, comparing yourself to others is a form of bookkeeping. All right? I mean, that doesn't even need to be said, but I probably should say it anyway. Always keeping track, checking their success, how many followers they have, how do they seem to be doing financially. Wow, she's thinner. Oh man, he's so much stronger. You know what I'm talking about, right? Comparing is just the same form of bookkeeping. But when you move into a new mode, when you die to the bookkeeping, that just doesn't hold the same appeal as it did before. If you move to love, unmerited favor, grace and gift is the ground of my being. Everything I was striving for, I already have. Then who has what, who appears to be getting ahead, where it looks like I'm falling behind, just becomes the most boring game in the world. You're at a party and you run into people who are still in the bookkeeping thing, measuring, checking their columns. You got QuickBooks of the soul, right? QuickBooks of the soul kill you. Woo! Now, just a few more thoughts here to wrap this up, which is really just beginning the conversation. Are you with me on this? I love the fact that the story begins by Jesus saying the kingdom of God is like, the kingdom of heaven is like. Because he comes to inaugurate a new way of being in the world. So this is way beyond, we'll talk about religion in a second, but this is way beyond like what religion you're a part of. Completely the wrong discussion. He comes to witness, to announce, to proclaim, to inaugurate, to initiate, to catalyze a new way of being in the world. So you want to have a big life. You want to experience the transcendent and the divine. You want to be in the flow. It will always involve some sort of death to the old and entering into the new. See, the problem with a lot of what passes for religion is that it allows you to stay in the same old mode. So the who's right, who's wrong, who's in, who's out, a lot of times religion is just the same old bookkeeping game with nice Bible verses and religious language attached. Yeah, it's always, always about this mysterious grace that invites you to die so that you can really live. The kingdom of heaven, when he talks about the kingdom of God, he's talking about a new way of ordering things. He's not just talking about nice moral teachings, although there is that. He's not just talking about an ethical standard, although there is that, or how to escape hell. Well, he is saying here, if you don't want to be tortured, if you don't want to live a life in which you torture yourself, here's how to do it. But it's about a new way of being. It's about the way of the divine, the realm of the divine, heaven and earth in the same place, earth as it could and should be. It's about that experience. It's about that experience. So maybe that's your prayer. Maybe that's your mantra. Is maybe you are weary because you have been stuck playing the same old games. I even honestly, people trying to prove the existence of God and show you that God is not dead, part 1, 2, and 3. People trying to show that they're not, like, seriously, it's the wrong discussion. He doesn't come for an argument. This mysterious grace, this death and rebirth built into the fabric of the whole thing, it's about an experience of the depths of life. People talking about their religion is right, theirs is wrong, it's the wrong discussion. Because it's an invitation to an experience of a new way of ordering the world. Yeah, it's way better. It's way better. It's way better than any of that. Good news is better than that. And once again, Jesus tells this story with so much packed into it. And the servant, the man who owes all the money, he goes through the whole story without experiencing and entering into the mystery. So there's your prayer. There's your mantra. It's like you just say, please show me what it looks like to enter into it. Because it'll be a new mode. The old discussions and arguments and debates simply won't be interesting. You'd be like, oh my word, people are still talking about that? Are you kidding me? It's so much better over, it's so much better in this new space. Yeah. Oh, so good. So may you, my brothers and sisters, may you stop clinging to your bookkeeping. May you toss the books on yourself, on others. If there's somebody who has wronged you and you're still holding on to it, it's honestly torturing you. May you toss the books on them. Of course, they don't deserve it. Neither do you. Yeah. May you play a different game. May you see the whole thing as an absurd, unmerited, gratuitous, over-the-top gift. And may you enter into that. May you die to whatever you need to die to, so that you can really live. And may grace and peace be with you every step of the way.